Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Dave Scott and associate producer Stephanie Collins. As you've come to know, every day of this week, every day of the next couple of months, we begin with the voice of Colonel Vindman. As he was testifying during the impeachment hearing, you will have it committed to memory by the time the November 2020 election arrives, but maybe it's important that his words are ringing in your ears as you go in to vote when he assures his pop that it'll be okay. And not only did we learn that it was not okay for him, we have now seen that nothing is okay for anyone living in America today. All right, the words of Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearing of 2019.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
If it's Friday, it must be Scott Braddock. And if it must be Scott Braddock, it must be the editor of the Quorum Report. It must be the voice of Texas. It must be the dean of the Austin Press Corps. It must be the man that has taught me more about Texas than any human being on the planet. So now the second largest state in the nation has become almost as important to me as my little state of New Hampshire. So let me welcome to the program Scott Braddock. How are you, Scott?
I'm well, Arnie. How are you? Are you in place sheltering?
I am so sheltering in place. I go out once a week to do food shopping. Mm-hmm. And I wore a mask today for the first time shopping. In fact, some woman posted on my Facebook page. So here's what happens. I go to the store. This is a little store called Aldi. And you have to put a quarter in to get your container.
Mm-hmm.
And
I love Aldi. I'm all about it.
Me too.
They have them in Dallas. I don't think they have them in Houston.
I love them. So I wipe down my handle. I put my quarter in. They have a social distance. It was great. They now have this thing so you can't sort of, you can see the cashier, but there's a plastic around him. And I go back to my car and I'm putting stuff in my car. And this woman is getting out next to me. I said to her, "Do you want my basket?" Mm-hmm. And she said, "Yes." And so she said, "Would you like the quarter?" I said, "Yes." And so we tried to figure out how to be 6 feet apart and still hand each other a quarter. And then she posts on Facebook, "I was just at Aldi. I think the woman with the mask who offered me her cart was Arnie Arneson. Oh my God, I wasn't sure. That mask made it difficult for me to recognize her." So just to let you know, I've been sheltering in place and doing all those things that you're supposed to do. So
it's brilliant. And I love Aldi. I'm sure they're doing a wonderful job. You may have heard our pride of Texas, the grocery store is called HEB. They have been HEB has been getting all sort of, just accolades for the way they have handled all of this. HEB is a staple in Texas, although they have had very responsible growth, Arnie. And I like to refer to HEB, and I mean this in a good way. Mm-hmm. HEB is a cartel because they will always get the thing that's needed to the place it's needed. And it goes back, many years in Texas. The family, it's a privately owned company. Mm-hmm. You'll laugh. The HEB, the B stands for butt. The last name is B-U-T-T, just like it sounds. But they have been doing business here for many, many years. Their relationships went back to Lyndon Johnson and others. For example, when Johnson was in Congress, he and the Butt family had an understanding and agreement when they needed to be able to bring things out of Mexico and he needed to maybe slip an amendment into a bill in Washington so that they could bring grapefruits out of Mexico.
Right, so
they were going to bring grapefruits out of Mexico. They got it done. Well, there's a great story I'll point people to, and I won't recount the whole thing now. But if you go to Texas Monthly, they have a wonderful story about how HEB prepared for the pandemic.
It's amazing.
Way, when the when Hurricane Katrina happened, and the more recent one, Hurricane Harvey happened, you had the people saying that, you know what, FEMA ought to be run by HEB.
I saw the Texas Monthly article. Mm-hmm. Read it. These guys should be running the country right now. We wanted to know why we don't have enough N95s, we don't have enough. They are so good at organizing, at making sure the supply chains are in place. They're brilliant. They're brilliant. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Absolutely. They had started communicating with their counterparts in January, way back at the beginning of the year, because they knew things were going to start happening. But of course, in the story, as you saw, since you read it, the fact is nothing could have gotten them or anybody else ready for the fact that people would be hoarding toilet paper. And let me say something to shame everybody who was hoarding toilet paper.
Okay.
But the fact is, nothing could have prepared any of the stores out there for people running to get all the toilet paper in the stores, which we should, just publicly shame all these people, Arnie. There was no shortage, except for the fact that people were buying all of it. There's no supply chain issue. There's no reason other than people hoarding it in their homes that people didn't have toilet paper. So stop that, people.
Right. Well, HEB and Aldi are two places that I just thought were there. Aldi has been responsible. They're changing all the grocery stores now. Are now staggering people in. They're cleaning off all the carts. So we're seeing the grocery stores are beginning to realize they are frontline workers and that their people are very important. They are in some ways as essential as the medical people, because in the end, if you wanted people to shelter in place, you need to make sure that they can feel safe going to a store and coming home and not getting the disease, because if they get it, then they have to then burden the hospital. So we're all connected, Scott. Connected.
That's right. NPR had a great story about, featuring the folks who are also frontline folks, the people who work in the grocery stores and wherever we go to, stock up our pantries. What's going on in Texas, Arnie? We have had confusion. We have had a governor who kind of dithers. You remember when Governor Abbott, was leading the state through the 2017 session of the legislature, and the lieutenant governor decided that the thing we were going to focus on was who could use which public restrooms in Texas. The governor, of course, was sort of bullied into his position on that and was calling for this bathroom bill to be passed. And about a week ago, I had predicted that the governor would be sort of bullied right into Patrick's position when it came to COVID-19 and the response here, because the governor doesn't lead, he sort of leads from behind. Well, do you remember there was a guy named Steve Hotze, the big anti-LGBTQ activist in Houston? He runs the Conservative Republicans of Texas PAC, and he's been on a mission for about 30 years or so against the gays in Texas. I mean, this is the guy who was stand on a stage in Houston holding a sword and say, drive the gays out of our city.
Oh,
well, Hotze the former chairman of the Republican Party in Harris County, where Houston is, they had sued. They are taking the county to court at the Texas Supreme Court, asking that the churches stay open for services on Sundays, even though Harris County has put a stay-at-home order in place because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Here's the headline, Arnie. Not even a week later, Governor Abbott sides with Steve Hotze in fight over Houston area church closures during the pandemic. The governor issued what he called a stay-at-home order, and he gave a press conference this week that confused the hell out of a lot of people. They didn't understand exactly what he was saying. Is he saying stay at home? We're the biggest of states that has not had a stay-at-home order, when even Florida had gone ahead this week with a stay-at-home order. But of course, New York, California, those governors have put shelter-in-place, stay-at-home orders that they issued a while back at this point. The governor tried to clarify in a video yesterday that he does want people to stay home with some exceptions. Then he talked about essential businesses. Here's the interesting thing, Arnie. In the order, he lists church services as essential, And he encourages churches to go ahead and do virtual services, you know, have them online, or have people come to sort of like a drive-through to see the priest if they need to do that, that sort of thing, which has been done in some places. And I don't think anybody's saying that people shouldn't practice their faith. I remember when I was a kid, Arnie, remember how you would go to church and they would talk about how the church is not the building, it's the people.
Yes, yes.
Oh, the church is... The church is the people, right?
I used to do that with my hands, remember?
Yes, you know, yes, the church, yes, and the steeple, yes. And the church
the steeple,
is the people.
Exactly, you know, exactly.
You know the whole little thing. So
I do.
So people can still worship, and there's no, and by the way, this has happened before where churches had to be shut down for various public health reasons. It's not a violation of their right to assemble if it's a public health situation, but these folks, the conservative Republicans of Texas, which by the way is its own little group, it's not the Republican Party in Texas or anything, they see it differently. They say that the churches ought to be open. Well, Arnie, this is causing confusion, and I pointed out on Twitter this week that, and this is true across the United States, I know it's true here in Texas, I probably sound like George W. Bush, I know it's true in Texas, for the elderly folks out there, for a lot of people, going to church on Sunday is the best thing about their life. As somebody pointed out on my social media, you know, their grandparent, the only time they get out of the nursing home is to go to church on Sunday.
They want to be able to do that.
And for the governor to offer what I think at best is a confusing message about it is very unhelpful, because we're talking about the population that's the most at risk for catching the disease and then dying from it, right? The elderly folks, the you know, the 65, 70, 85-year-old person who would go to a big gathering. And somebody was telling me in West Texas, you may have heard of something called the House of Yahweh. It's one of these fundamentalist churches that's it's too insane to even be considered right wing or anything like that, although they probably have those sorts of politics. But out in, I think it's Callahan County, these folks had been in the Abilene area and they moved out to a more rural area. And just in the last few days, they were still telling the people who are part of their faith that they were still going to have a 5-day feast next week, inviting thousands of people to come. And Arnie, if they do that, they'll be doing an event with thousands of people in a rural part of Texas where there is no hospital if any of them get sick. And so this is a confusing moment for Texans. They don't really understand what the governor is saying. He's trying to say, look, it is a stay-at-home order. You're expected to stay home, but there are all these exceptions. And you just haven't seen this kind of message coming from Andrew Cuomo in New York or Gavin Newsom in California. They have been very clear. By the way, you may have seen Sheldon Adelson, the big GOP mega donor who runs Las Vegas Sands Corporation and the big casinos in Las Vegas. He was praising, I think it was in the New York Post this morning, he had an op-ed where he was praising Cuomo and Newsom. He didn't praise Abbott. I didn't see his name in there. Wow. He was talking about Republican and Democratic governors. He talked about Governor DeWine in Ohio, and he talked about how they have been decisive. They have been swift, and they need to be that way in a global pandemic. They've got to give people clear instructions, and people need to see a leader actually lead.
Let me just go on, Arnie.
You know the issue with leading, right?
Yeah.
At first, it looks like you're walking by yourself. So so these folks, they get out there. And guys like Cuomo have been leading on this and saying, here's what's coming. This is going to come in a big wave. And what has happened? Exactly that. And so in Texas, we continue to have confusion. It allows for Lieutenant Governor Patrick to go on Fox News and say, well, maybe the senior citizens out there, maybe they would like to sacrifice their lives in exchange for a healthy economy, which, of course, he spent about a week walking those comments back.
So I want to stop you really quickly, because I totally agree with you. The confusion is incredible. And I want to remind everyone, even the Pope understood. And he basically said, you're not getting together for church. You know, I mean, this is just not going to happen. But of course, we're not probably talking about Catholics in Texas. We're probably talking about more the evangelical Christians in Texas. Mm-hmm. But here's the thing. It's not about the old people dying. It's not about the people dying at these huge mega church events. It's about the fact that they are going to crush the healthcare system that's already being crushed by everyone coming in. And I don't understand why every healthcare provider isn't filing another lawsuit at the Texas Supreme Court and said, if you allow this, then what you are doing is you are breaking us, because it isn't just about them in their rural areas. It's about the fact that we're already strained, and you are now really putting a gun to our head because you're just adding to our burden. And I think that I would file another lawsuit. I'm sorry, Scott. And this is, the governor's afraid to lead. The governor's afraid of the evangelicals. He better be afraid of the medical community, of every nurse, of every EMT, of every firefighter who's saying, you are going to kill us. Who's going to be hurt.
You're saying something very important, Arnie.
Oh, my God.
This is something that I think goes right by a lot of people when we talk about this wave of COVID-19 cases. It's not just that the hospital system's overwhelmed with the COVID-19 or coronavirus cases.
Right.
It's that they then can't also deal with everybody who might come in for something else. Right.
Exactly.
And I think people miss that. If you would go in with, maybe you were in a motorcycle accident.
Exactly.
Maybe you had a heart attack. Maybe you had whatever. And people right now in New York, I saw this morning on CNN, in New York, people are going to an emergency room and waiting for 3 hours to even wait in the next line, where they wait for 11 hours before they can even see, before they can even be triaged. I mean, we're talking about a complete overwhelming situation for them there. And look, when the lieutenant governor says that maybe older folks might like to sacrifice themselves for the sake of the economy, let me say something about that. Because I've had about a week to think about it now. And when he first said it, of course, it's easy to just sort of dismiss Dan Patrick as, you know, he's always over the top. He's always going to, you know, steal the show. But I do think that he's saying something that just, it gives you a window into exactly what kind of misunderstanding there is about this. We have it baked into our psyche as Americans that sometimes self-sacrifice is the thing that has to happen. And we think about the World War II generation, the greatest generation. They did that, right? And self-sacrifice in that instance means you give up your life, or you're injured in a battle, and that helps secure the freedom of others. And that's the way we kind of understand it, probably the way he understands it. And let me give this example, Arnie. Self-sacrifice for you and me might be, let's say, the simplest example. There's a kid playing in the street, and a car's coming. And the kid doesn't realize that the car is coming. So you jump in front of the car, push the kid out of the way, and you either die or you get seriously injured as a result. And that's self-sacrifice, because you saved the kid, and that would be a good thing. Now try this. Replace the car with the virus. So the virus is coming down the street, and you run out to push the kid out of the way. But unless you can push the kid more than 6 feet away, it's going to hit you both. And then guess what? And then guess what? Because you've been hit by it, you don't die right then. You walk around the whole neighborhood with it, and you give everybody in the neighborhood the virus. The right. point I'm making is that the idea that we have about self-sacrifice in this country, it doesn't match up with the reality of the virus. That's not the way it works. And let me say it this way, and this is very difficult for a lot of my conservative Republican friends to understand, because self-sacrifice means something. Here's the deal. In this virus, we're talking about collective sacrifice. We're all sacrificing by being home, by staying away from each other. It's not self-sacrifice. It's collective sacrifice that we all have to do to make sure that the hospital system doesn't get overwhelmed, to make sure that our neighbors don't die, and all of that.
So let me tell you what I'm writing right now. I'm writing a note to my daughters, in case, God forbid, I'm sheltering in place. I'm doing everything. I clean everything. I don't see people. I've made my own mats. I go out once a week. I'm treating everything like I have the disease, and I act that way. So I'm trying to almost hermetically seal myself so I don't contract it, or I don't give it to someone. But here's another note I'm writing. This is the self-sacrifice I want you to share with your lieutenant governor. And that is, if I come down with the disease, even despite every good thing I do, because I'm listening to everything and I care about my community, but if I come down with it and I get very ill, after 5 days on a ventilator, I want them to pull it. That's my sacrifice. Find a younger person who can survive and needs it more than me. I don't want to be on a ventilator for 20 days and die. Or 15 days and die. After 5 days, it means I'm probably having a really tough bout. I am 66 years old. That will be my self-sacrifice. I'm giving them the order, pull it. That is my self-sacrifice. But right now, it's the community sacrifice that we all have to be together and recognize it. And you know what? When I saw that article in Texas Monthly, sorry about this, everyone. So when I saw the article at the Texas Monthly, Scott, what I got so upset about was that I wanted to call Dan Patrick and describe to him what community sacrifice was and what individual sacrifice. If he wants individual, I can package it for him, but I don't want to package it the way he wants to. I need to package it the way we protect everyone, especially the frontline doctors, especially the system that's crushed.
After the lieutenant governor made that comment, there were people joking here. Two things. One, it sounds like an offer's on the table. And then two, people were saying, well, if he goes to the hospital, what I want to hear is that he's going to turn away the ventilator, right? And give that to somebody else.
Exactly. So let's talk about something else with me. And the other thing I want to ask you is there's a town or a city in Texas that is actually putting an order in that everybody must wear masks. They are saying that you have to wear a mask, especially going to any kind of a public building. They're actually setting a curfew. I mean, this is Texas. I was just so shocked because the most extreme reaction to what's happening from COVID-19 is now actually taking place in this such libertarian Texas place where you're getting no leadership for the most part, or confusing leadership from your governor. And yet in this community in Texas, what are you seeing? You're seeing the city council really exercising almost the kind of orders you would hear in a place like China, to be honest with you. I applaud them for what they're trying to do, but it was so shocking when I realized the location of where it was coming from.
Well, this is coming from Laredo, Democratic area down in South Texas in the Valley. But all across the state, Arnie, there are various orders in place. We haven't had the statewide shelter in place or stay at home order from the governor. But in places like Dallas County, Harris County, Tarrant County, also here in Travis County, where I live in Austin, and down in Bear County, where San Antonio is, they have had some pretty strict rules that they have put in place. But we're over 100 counties now where we have at least one case of COVID-19. And I think that we're going to continue to see these local orders put in place and the local leadership, take that lead role in trying to keep Texans safe, at least as long as the governor continues to offer up what are pretty confused orders.
Okay, so we get these confusing orders. We have lawsuits going on about, I don't know how long the list of exempt institutions were. I mean, so he's saying, you have to shelter in place except if you work for. And I'm sort of curious. My governor, I think, in the state of New Hampshire, I think it's 11 pages. I mean, basically, it's hairdressers and nail people for the most part, and schools. Mm-hmm. So I'm just kind of curious. That's the other thing, too, is that when you hear the order, you think, wow, isn't this wonderful? What I think we need to recognize is that you better look at the laundry list of exempted places, like is it construction workers? Is it whatever? And that, I think, is also challenging. So people need to begin to say, does this make sense?
We are going to have an interesting report on Quorum Report by the time this interview airs about the construction industry and how they're handling that in Texas. One of the arguments that has been made, which is a pretty good one actually, is that one, for construction workers and for construction sites, they have specific control over who comes on and off of that site. And they're doing temperature checks when people walk in. That's one thing. The other thing that I found really interesting is the government appreciates that they have a ready workforce that is, still employed in the construction industry right now, because the Army Corps of Engineers might say tomorrow, we need to stand up a hospital over there. We need to have extra facilities over there to do this. And so we'll see how that plays out. But all across the state here in Texas, construction is still going on. The different businesses that are considered essential, I mean, we're talking grocery stores and other things that we talked about at the beginning of this. And as we also talked about, the order from Governor Abbott includes all the essentials that are considered essential at the federal level under the federal guidance that's been put out. Mm-hmm. But the only thing the governor added to that was church services.
Well, and let me just say one other thing about construction. We also found out that guess what construction workers have? N95 masks.
That's right.
So a lot of, and I keep telling people, I went to China to see my daughter, and this is back in 2013. Everybody's walking around with a mask. Well, there wasn't COVID-19 then. You know what it was? Right. It was pollution. That's why everyone in China is wearing a mask. That's part of the reason why they had thousands of masks stored in every house in China, because of the pollution. But when you look at the construction industry, it turns out people were so shocked when they found out that the construction companies had thousands and thousands of N95s. Well, they need them because as they're doing construction, guess what? They're creating all these particles in the air, and they have to protect their workers from basically breathing in these particles. So to a large extent, in some ways, the construction industry was more prepared for COVID-19 than a lot of other industries, which I think is also interesting.
Absolutely, in a lot of ways. And I've also seen a lot of construction firms around Texas because their orders have been pulled back or their projects have been extended for their deadlines. So they don't have as many people on the job site.
Exactly.
There are a lot of construction firms that have donated thousands of those to the medical workers.
Okay. Well, I just want to say thank you so much. We will keep watching Governor Abbott.
Yes, we will.
And what I'm trying to figure out is that as I'm looking at Governor Abbott and he's sort of giving this sort of, you know, leading from behind, is he doing anything about the detention centers? And so many of them are in Texas and Louisiana. And there's, I know, an ACL lawsuit about releasing those people that are in detention. Has he weighed in or is he sort of hiding under the bench?
You're talking about immigrant detention centers?
Yeah.
No, not on that front. However, there is a fight going on with Harris County, which is the largest county in Texas where Houston is. And they have talked about releasing folks who are low-level offenders, nonviolent offenders. You had the governor and the attorney general. Only in Texas, Arnie, the indicted attorney general taking the position that people who are under indictment shouldn't be able to bond out and get out of the jail in Harris County. But the governor and the AG said they were only focused on making sure that violent offenders don't get released. That seemed like chest thumping because what they're talking about at the local level is only releasing those folks who are nonviolent offenders. And that's because jails are one of the places where the virus would spread the quickest because people are packed in like sardines.
And on that note, Scott Braddock, editor of the Quorum Report, voice of Texas, dean of the Austin Press Corps. If it's Friday, it must be Texas. Thank you so much for joining us. And we're going to keep an eye on Abbott. That's what I'm promising you.
We fought our way through all the noise, Arnie. I'll talk to you next week.
All right, ciao. Bye-bye. Stick around. Little Climate Connections is next. And then we come back, Bill Curry. Actually, that conversation we had about prisons with Scott, I think we may flesh it out with Bill Curry. He's coming on next. Stick around.
Trout in the Classroom on this current cast. Some students across Pennsylvania are helping raise brook trout in classroom aquariums. And it's not just a front row seat to the life cycle of the fish. Amity Daniel of the Pennsylvania Fish and Boat Commission says the students also learn about water quality through hands-on activities. For example, by comparing the conditions in the tank to a local stream.
The students are gaining an ownership of the health of the brook trout in the classroom. And through that, they gain a connection to that local watershed.
At the end of the year, they release the trout. The program is over, but for many students, an interest in conservation remains. CurrentCast, produced with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future and made possible by the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. Online at currentcast.org.
To part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Dave Scott and associate producer Stephanie Collins. Joining us right now is one of our all-time faves. He's got a following now around the country. Bill Curry was an advisor to Bill Clinton. He ran for the governor of the great state of Connecticut twice. He has written for Salon.com. If you are a progressive anywhere in the country, you have known of him, you've heard of him. or you want him to come to your event to speak to them, because he is one of the more eloquent people I know. And this is a time where eloquence is necessary, I think. We're all afraid. We're all confused. We're all trying to focus on the facts. But to some extent, I feel like some of the facts keep changing as we learn more about this disease and we begin to figure out how do we make the adjustments. Do we wear a mask? Don't we wear a mask? What is the expectation on us as individuals? What's the expectation on us as a society? And how much can government deliver, especially government now led by a dysfunctional man named Donald Trump? So as I'm looking at all this, Bill, I'm looking at all the stories that are coming out of these interesting public-private partnerships, of these interesting things about reevaluating who's in our prisons. I'm looking at how you run an election by November of 2020. Someone sent me a really cute tweet this morning and they said, so we think that maybe it's Joe Biden is the nominee for the Democratic Party. Bernie hasn't left the stage yet, but we think it's Joe Biden. And they said, so can you name me anything memorable that Joe Biden has said in the last 2 weeks? And I was like, I can name you some memorable things that Andrew Cuomo has said. It's going to be a challenge for whoever the nominee is, because this disease has overwhelmed messaging and it's overwhelmed an ability to campaign, because Donald Trump has those ridiculous press conferences every day. The Democrat that gets the most attention is the governor of New York. So as you look at this sort of hodgepodge, how do you weave a political future for the Democratic Party as they look at really not only having primaries to go through, but an election that they want to win in November?
You could you could frame that question even more succinctly. Can you remember anything Joe Biden, anything eloquent Joe Biden has ever said? Question mark. Not just in the last 2 weeks. And it's just not, and it's truly, I don't say it just to be catty, but I can't, and I follow this stuff pretty closely. It's not part of his skill set. But that's not the only problem. I would just say that, again, my constant mantra, as you know by now, is that policy precedes message. First figure out what you think and then how to tell people about it. He's not great at being eloquent. He is great, pretty darn good at conveying empathy, and sometimes it seems authentic enough to me that I believe it. And that's rare enough in a public figure, and he should get credit for it. But the deeper problem here is that I think, again, it's something I also say a lot here and other places, is that we have this consultant think, where people advising office holders or candidates tell them how to treat everything that happens as a public relations crisis. It's as bad as Trump treating this as an economic crisis, rather public health crisis. Therefore, they just look for the safest and most, they want a balance between the safest thing they can say and the most pungent thing they can say. They want it in a soundbite, but they don't want to take any risks with it. I wish the Democrats a while ago, as a party led by Biden, had taken a strong a stand in favor of a 50-state lockdown as the
exactly.
most economically
exactly.
And smart, and you know that Biden's not surrounded by stupid people. He's surrounded by conventional people. And that if you're a pollster and a consultant and an old political factotum and you're on the phone call, nobody wants to take the risk of putting the candidate on the record for something that isn't instantly popular everywhere. So it's a lot easier to find a couple of phrases that criticize Trump than it is to say, number one, we're locking down. There's no other way to do this. Number two, the government's taking over. Not just the War Production Acts to be cited here and there, as we've been suggesting, but across the board, we're taking over procurement, we're taking over distribution of everything that's related to this question. And then the third thing is that our Manhattan Project for this year is about medication and vaccination. And that there has to be a central place where all the data, as by the way, with all national security questions, there has to be a central place where all the data is collected and shared, open source.
Open source. I was just thinking that.
With everybody.
Yeah.
And so those are three things, a national strategy and rule on all questions of the restriction of socialization and travel. And
so, I want to go to
the government takes over procurement and the government begins to collect and share all the data. And I just want to say one last thing, and that is that we do the opposite of these in so many ways, but just in the data point, that we've gone this far settling for, even from Fauci, bromides like, well, we're really ramping up, as opposed to we're going to have X amount of tests available in the following states by the following date. That somewhere that information exists. We all have a right to it. The government works for us. Lots of people armed with the facts will do smarter things than they're doing right now because they'll have more information. And so that basic question of freedom of information, which is such a vital question in this democracy, has never been more vital. There are things like this that we should be pounding out every day.
Okay, I agree with you. So let's start with the 50-state solution. And the reason why I've been screaming that bill forever, okay? But no, I have no echo chamber. No echo chamber from Biden, no echo chamber from the Democratic Party, no echo chamber. The closest thing I got to an echo chamber was Dr. Fauci, where he said the most extreme thing you should do, you should probably do. That was code for a 50-state shutdown.
Yeah.
But he has to work for frickin' Donald Trump. The Democratic Party are also cowards. And let's remember when Joe Biden sort of came to fruition. Let's go back to Ronald Reagan and new frickin' federalism. Basically, all the states were sort of on their own jack. Well, the Democratic Party rejected that, but they kind of forgot because they started adopting that idea of all the sort of states having a different response. Well, what you are asking for is what the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party has always understood. We are the United States of America, that there is something more than geography that connects us together, something even more than, frankly, even a constitution that connects us together, is that we have to act as a country. You know, not as the individual fiefdoms. And with this disease, you know, you have to act as one, because one weak link basically infects everyone. Look what happened with Florida. Everybody was down in Florida having a good time, and then they came home. Well, they came home with the disease that they got in Florida because they didn't shut down the damn beaches or Florida. And I think that's part of the problem. So I think what's so sad is the Democrats have even forgotten what they believed in, and what they believed in is operative now more than ever. But they forgot the words, they forgot the music, they forgot how to sort of say it, because they keep waiting for someone else to say it. No. Leadership is that you say it, and then people figure out you are right.
I agree 100% with that. I just want to take slight issue with an implication of that, or possible implication of what you just said, and that is regarding Dr. Fauci, whom I met a couple times and have followed a little bit over the years, and it seems to be a very credible a guy. In some ways, though, he's like the Bob Mueller of the pandemic. He's a person
very good. Write an op-ed. He's
a person who we all respected late in his career, who's tried to play this tried to play the game straight, but is such an institutional survivor that he was always playing the game. He was playing it straight, but he was playing it. That sort of comes with that. And then in the end, he played by old rules and protocols that didn't really apply because he didn't understand the difference. And I admire Fauci, in many ways. But when you say that he's saying a 50-state lockdown in code doesn't cut it.
You're right.
Code doesn't cut it.
Oh God.
And I'm sick of having to interpret even Fauci and Burks for the average person. I'm just sick of it. And they do what every Trump appointee has done. They tell themselves that they are so indispensable. They tell themselves that they're so needed to keep them from doing the next terrible thing that they stay on in silence, and they pander to them in ways they shouldn't. And what they're doing that at that point, as Mueller did, they are failing in their first responsibility. They are the town criers.
Yes.
More than
yes.
anything. Again, Anthony Fauci's not running logistics. He's not running procurement. He's not doing any of those things that an administrator does. His day is actually spent absorbing the facts on the ground and distilling them into messages for the public. And that is his number one job, actually, on a day-to-day basis. And in absorbing those facts, he's also making policy recommendations. But The first thing, his first obligation is to serve us, not Trump. And he's not doing that at a time when that getting that clear information out in a way that everybody understands is absolutely paramount. He's not lying like Trump every day, but he's not doing enough of his own job, period.
Okay, so I agree with you. I mean, again, majestic disappointment is how I feel about Fauci. And and if he's afraid of being fired, then go. Let him be fired. It would be far better.
Far better to be fired and free to say what you think.
Exactly.
The press would come, and he could then tell them the truth in an unvarnished way. Again, man.
He's had
a fine career.
I know.
He's very, very bright. I don't in any sense want to personalize it. But it truly is really, really important. And by the way, they should all just look at every person who's taken this strategy with Trump. They all think they kept him from doing something horrible. Fauci says in error that Trump listens to him, that he's confusing correlation with causation. Trump sometimes does things that he advised him to do, but not because he advised him to do it, but because the polls said he had to do it.
So let me just say something.
Whenever Trump gets political advice that coincides with Fauci's advice, he takes it.
All right. So let me just say something. So Ken was saying, but if he leaves the stage, he won't have influence. Let me just tell you something. Actually, he'd have greater influence in some ways if he leaves the stage, because all the media will follow him. He will have get more time. What does Donald Trump hate? He hates anyone who gets more FaceTime than him. He hates anyone who's getting more coverage in the New York Times than him. He hates anyone who basically is being more respected and admired than him. Like somehow this, I mean, one of the reasons why he's holding these ridiculous, ridiculous press conferences every day is that he misses being on the campaign trail. He thinks it's an opportunity for him to sort of show his leadership. And then we just heard that MSNBC and CNN have decided they're going to punt and they're not going to cover these conferences. And let me just say something. Well, I agree.
That's a public health decision as well as a journalistic call.
Thank you. Thank you.
And again, all the people standing behind Trump should realize that they're really not much more than a bobblehead ornaments on a dashboard.
That's exactly what.
And that what they're doing is lending credibility to these press conferences, and the press conferences misinform more than they inform. They are the reason that 40% of the country isn't taking a plague seriously.
Yes.
4 out of 10 Americans aren't taking the plague seriously.
Yes.
And the most culpable people for that are Rupert Murdoch and Donald Trump.
Right.
But for the good-hearted people who led credible and even exemplary careers in government, it's time to realize that all those people who stuck around enabling Trump got little for it.
Exactly. So when I saw the article from Newsweek about CNN and MSNBC cutting away from Trump's coronavirus briefing, I posted it on Facebook this way. I said, great. We can read the media coverage by journalists paid to attend after the fact. We miss nothing but the political theater directed by our liar in chief every day. And of course, his personal performance that just confirms he is mad and vindictive.
That's pretty much what it's all about. You know, I wish he were doing better. I wish the Democrats and Biden were doing policy. I wish they were laying down policy. I wish Fauci were laying down policy more clearly. And Fauci should just, you know, someone should tell him. Andrew Cuomo shouldn't have to carry all the water on this.
It's time
to help him out, pal.
Well, but you're absolutely right. It is time to help Andrew Cuomo out. And Andrew Cuomo, I think he has even said we need a 50-state solution. He's even said, you know, New York is not an island. All now of the Northeast now has basically shut down. But again, what he knows is that this is a 50-state problem with a 50-state response. And I think that that's important. But there's another issue that I also want to touch on. So, we did the press conferences. We've talked about the 50-state solution. We're looking at Joe Biden, who we're waiting for something coming out of him. But the other problem I have is we also know that a lot of the governors are facing really life and death issues, not just about what's happening in their hospitals that are being overloaded, but they have prisons. They have state prisons, there are county prisons, there are federal prisons, and the prisons are places where it's kind of like the cruise ship. You know, there's nowhere to go. You're kind of stuck there. And if anyone comes down with COVID-19, then the potential is for everyone to come down with COVID-19. And at least with a cruise ship, you're probably rich enough that you can, you know, eventually, if they let you come into port, you can go someplace and quarantine. But what happens at the detention centers and what happens at the prisons is that that doesn't happen. So what do we do about what we know is a death camp? That's really what they are. They may have done something, but they don't deserve dying in prison because they may have, you know, robbed a 7-Eleven, or they may have done something, I don't know, had five DWIs, but that doesn't mean that they should be ignored. And yet at the same time, we warehouse more people in prison than any country in the world. And it hasn't made us safer, and we've made so many mistakes. And now look what we have created at the time of COVID-19.
You know, I agree strongly with the major points that you just made. I would say a couple of things. I don't know enough about the conditions in the prisons. I don't know enough about any of the underlying data for anything that's happening right now, to go back to my earlier point about freedom of information.
Right, right.
But I don't know enough to call them death camps myself. And I don't know enough to know, therefore, what exactly the next right move is. But I fundamentally agree with the idea that we should be getting out of there, the people we can get out in a way that protects the general public health and safety and the public health and safety of the prisoners themselves. And so what kind of, you know, we talked a little bit about this before, but I would just want to make sure we'd worked out the right transition.
Exactly.
I don't know that, you know, putting a lot of people who haven't been tested into a big gymnasium is the right idea, but getting them into dormitory rooms might be the right idea. Once again, by the way, just to underscore for everyone, the unconscionable, incomprehensible failure of the federal government to meet the testing needs makes this, like, this is just like every other conversation we could have on the topic of coronavirus. If we could test them all, we would know much better what to do with all of them. And the second thing is, lastly, that the transition to community is a hard enough thing for all prisoners, doubtless made harder here. And
With COVID,
knowing that they have that you only let people go who have a place to go, and you know, some way of keeping safe on the outside.
So there's a couple.
If I just introduce one idea, the last thing is that, by the way, since almost all of those people don't belong in jail to begin with, the nonviolent
offenders, that's my point.
One thing we could add to the discussion: we should just handle the public health aspect of this now. But once it's done, I would suggest that everybody be allowed, contingent upon their continued good behavior, to remain at large after the pandemic passes. Right. And that we might just have an extraordinarily instructive social experiment in the United States as a result of this.
So there's a couple of things I want to say. At least in a prison setting, we may have some kind of oversight. What we have learned about the detention centers is that they were squalor before this, that they didn't have adequate anything before this.
Yes.
So, and the other problem with both the federal prison and the detention centers is that this isn't just about what happens to prisoners. It's about the guards. And at some point in time, the guards are already beginning to come down with the disease. They're already, and so you're going to see a situation where it isn't isolated to the people that you're warehousing. It is also the kind of thing where the people that are doing the oversight of the people that you're warehousing also contract the same disease. This is such a come to Jesus moment about what we need to do and how we need to deal with this fairly quickly, because if we don't, it will be what I just described. Because it's too easy, because they have no place to go. Right now, I know they're issuing quarantines. Right now, I know that Governor Raimondo of Rhode Island has let out, I think, 1,000 prisoners, and she says she's going to monitor them. What the hell does that mean? And so once again, I think it requires a sophisticated response. You don't want them to die. You also don't want them to go back into a community where they may not know if they have the disease, and where do they go? And I gave this sort of story to you where I got a letter from a guy at the local prison, and he's coming out at the end of April. And this is before the COVID-19 thing really sort of blew up. And he wanted to know whether he could live with me because he knows I rent rooms. And I get this note, and I'm like, and this is before I'm even thinking COVID-19. And I said to him, you know what, Mark, you're not reliable. That's why you're in jail. You know, I live with other people. I don't know if I can trust you. And now at the time of COVID-19, there is no way in hell that I'm going to let you come live with me. But more important, he has nowhere to go and he's on release. This is his date for release anyway. Think about all those people. Where do they go? And the last thing you want them to go is to go untested back into the community. It'll have an incredible blowback, but that doesn't mean you keep them there. It means you have to figure out how to segue them out. And I think that's really important as well. There are so many complicated issues here, Bill, and I don't know who's thinking about it in a sophisticated way because everybody's panicking and trying to get to a quick response, and a quick response is usually the wrong one.
One of the problems, to say something that everyone listening already knows, but one of the problems is that there is no federal policymaking. There are no federal policymaking instruments that are connected to the federal decision-making.
Right.
And therefore, that even, you know, we could do all this with federal prisons in pretty short order. And I'll bet there are some people who are thinking about it. I'll bet there are some people who proposed plans already. I'd be shocked if there weren't. But, you know, we learned today, you know, or we've been learning for the last week that the person in charge of the real person in charge of the response to coronavirus is the same person who manhandled the Middle East peace process and the reorganization of the bureaucracy, the illustrious Jared Kushner, who once again hasn't a single credential to bring to this assignment, not one of any kind. And who handles everything in terms of its politics and public relations. So we're not there. The good news is, I mean, there's some good news here. And the good news here is that this pandemic is giving us an opportunity to reimagine.
Yes.
Our entire economic, political, and social agenda of the United States. And when we come out of this, we won't be the same country we were. You sent me a piece today about support for Medicare for all going up.
Right.
It will be impossible for a Biden, Buttigieg, or Klobuchar type to talk about how much we love our insurance companies from this day forward. That's done now. That's all done. You'll never hear it come out of their mouths again for as long as we're here. And it doesn't mean we can all just switch right to Bernie's Medicare for all, but the support for it will keep going. I think we still have to do a transition piece, but we can get to universal health care with real cost containment and eventually to Medicare for all. We can get to the first overnight and to the second in good time. Our entire social contract has been laid bare in all of its injustice and insufficiency. And I think people are getting it. And so, again, it doesn't change a lot in terms of making sure that we answer the questions of the people who have concerns about how much we spend and whether we really know how to run the programs we set up. We have to continue to do that. But the opportunities here are tremendous. And I really see the country going two ways. I just don't know which way we'll be in the, you know, I said earlier in an earlier show, you know, I don't know if we're in the movie in which we all end up shooting each other or if we're in the movie in which we all end up building a barn. Together, you know,
right.
But the truth is that we're probably in both movies. And the truth is that for that, I think that there's a chance here that if we handle our responsibilities correct in the center to the left, that the shooters in the Trump group will shrink as a percentage of the population. And that the majority of Americans, a solid and dependable majority, will want to get into some serious barn building.
Right.
And so more than ever, to defeat them on the other side, the shooters, and to let the barn burners begin to collaborate on a different kind of future. I do, in the midst of all the sadness and depression and anxiety, I feel just as everyone else does about this. I really do have that hope.
And
I really do.
And here's I have that hope too. And one of the reasons why you asked this, you know, Joe Biden said anything memorable ever, is that in a way, your eloquence is what is needed. Wow. And in part, because because in a way, we know you're right. We need to hear it. It just reinforces what we see is wrong. And what we know is that there's hope there. There's an answer there. There's a solution there that we can fix it and make it better. And what this disease has done has actually been a form of Velcro. We're in this together. I don't care rich or poor, GOP or liberal, Democrat. It infects and kills all of us. All of us have to shelter in place, and most of us have lost our jobs. So in a way, there is this ability to hold us together. I don't want that to disappear after COVID. I want it to actually be morphed into something better for a better country. And so the voice of a Bill Curry, we need to find that on the national stage. Andrew Cuomo's good, but he's not you. And on that note, Mr. Curry, I need to end this. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arnison. I want to
love
thank
you.
That.
Stay
love
safe.
You too.
Stay
okay.
Well.
All right. I want to thank Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins for producing the show. And we'll talk about it. Take care. You've been